You are listening to a Science Actually production.
Honey?
What?
Where's my super suit?
What?
Where is my super suit?
We need to have more dance breaks in the show.
More? I like that you said we need to have more dance breaks. It implies that we don't have enough. We've been dancing and we need more of it.
Any number is any... Well, damn it. This is the problem with like studying theoretical pure mathematics. Like I was about to say any number is bigger than zero. It's like, well, no. Any positive real number is bigger than zero.
I have that problem like daily.
Yeah.
Let me ask you a question, Smarty McSmarts Pants.
Yeah.
Is the number one a prime number?
I mean, like, yes, but trivially. So often there are things that are like kind of like they're right, but they feel wrong. And it feels like too easy or too simple. And so that's often called like a trivial solution in maths.
Okay.
What's more confusing?
Go for it.
Sorry.
Oh, no, you please.
I was just going to say, like, so factorial, when you see a number with an exclamation mark, it's not like, a number. It's just that number multiplied by the next number down, multiplied by the next number down, and so on and so forth, right? So like 3 factorial, 3 with an exclamation mark is 3 times 2 times 1, right? And so 1 factorial is 1, right?
That's but zero play on the way down.
But 0 factorial is also 1.
Oh God.
So what were you gonna say?
I was at my son's scout meeting last night and all these super intelligent and curious kids of various teenage years are being kids. And one came up to me, Mr. Salas, is 1 a prime number? I was like, yeah. And he looks at me, he says, no, it's not. I'm like, I'm pretty sure it is. And he goes, no, it's not, because it doesn't have multiple factors. I'm like, okay. All right. And I said, you know what? I got a phone call with an astrophysicist tomorrow. I'll ask him. And he looked at me. You know an astrophysicist? I'm like, yeah, I know a few.
Boom. Yeah. Take that, teenage boy.
Oh, it was great. It was great.
And this is fun.
Then he laughed and he flew away.
He flew away. So we're not talking about theoretical mathematics today.
No.
Unfortunately.
No, unfortunately.
Damn, I got the ducks out for nothing.
Yeah, as everyone knows, you only bring out the ducks for theoretical mathematics. As Kavi clearly did. Yeah, you don't bring out ducks for comic book character conversation. Unless, of course, you're talking about Howard the Duck, who is a modern-day hero. Not now,
never talk about
but
him.
Time will tell. He will become a folk hero of some renown.
You will never catch me talking about Howard the Duck.
I just did.
Damn it! You win this round, sneaky. Sneaky man.
Why, Iota? No, this week we're talking about the science of superheroes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, the science of superheroes. there is a physics professor by the name of Jim Kakalios who has written a book about the science of superheroes. He's teaching physics and astrophysics, and he tries to tell his students that this information you're learning, these equations that you're learning, have real life uses. And all of them, across his years of teaching, what real life use do I have for this type of information? Then I grew up a comic book nerd, and he was trying to calculate the gravity by judging how big Superman is, what Superman's mass is, and if he did an average jump and that was enough to propel him however many hundreds of feet over a building, that's however many more times the strength of an average jump of a person on our planet. And if that amount of energy was about enough to get him, if that amount of energy was enough to make a normal looking jump on his planet, that's how he was able to calculate the gravity on Krypton. And he taught that to his students and they absorbed it. And he went on to teach all sorts of other things like electromagnetism and the conservation of momentum and all these other things, but using not real world examples, but comic books as examples. And his classes were filling up, and he wrote a one on book tours, and he gave all sorts of science advisory roles on various comic books and movies. And so we're talking about science and comic books.
I love it. I love it. And I feel a lot of it is
correct, actually. Please go on.
No, I was just going to say, so like I'm deep in the middle of the teaching semester here in Sydney, and it's kind of tough to find a way to like take these concepts that, as you said, are not always going to be super relatable and find a way to make students interested. So I guess you can either give examples of things as they relate or are analogous, at least to, you know, the student's day-to-day life, or you can do what Jim did and just be like, yeah, well, this is not about your life. It's not relevant, but what about Superman? And just find things that the students are already excited in and work off that. And yeah, just kudos to Jim. It's tough work teaching. So yeah, it's awesome to be on his way to engage.
Yeah. Well, you said Superman. Let's dive right in. In the very first appearance of Superman in Action Comics number one, in Superman's very first outing, nobody's seen him before. This is before he can fly and before the laser vision and a lot of other things. He was just the very earliest concept of Superman, just a very overpowered human. He's carrying a bad guy.
Man.
He's a Superman. He's carrying a bad guy under his arm as he's running atop a bunch of power lines through the city. And much to the horror of the bad guy he's carrying, the guy's screaming, "Those are power lines, we'll be fried." And Superman says, "Well, yeah, but not if I skip over the telephone poles. If I don't get grounded, we'll be fine." And he's right. He's right. He actually gave a correct answer as to why they'll be fine. Because Superman's super.
God, and I imagine this was before the days that people were so litigious that there was a need to have like a warning at the end of a comic saying like, "Please kids, don't try this at home. Don't climb up a telephone pole and only stand on the wires where they're not connected to the grounding poles."
Yeah. Well, back in the early days of Superman comics and comics in general, Superman killed a lot of people. But not really. It was much of more of like cornered the bank robber on the roof of the bank, and he took the canvas bag of money with a big money sign on it. And ha, you're not getting this today, bad guy. And he throws the bad guy off the roof and he just walks away. And that's the end of it. You don't know. You don't actually see the bad guy go over the edge of the roof and fall to his demise. But he's thrown away from the top of a building. And so a lot of that happened.
This is probably how supervillains were invented, because they wanted to give him the ability to fly safely away rather than focusing on maybe the more morbid realities of the outcomes.
Well, one of the first big supervillains is Victor Danning. Mm. And he was an original nemesis of Batman. And he made himself a supervillain by wanting to make himself the smartest man in the world, and therefore nobody could predict his schemes. And one day, he wanted to find the Batcave, the secret lair where Batman does his stuff. And he told his fellow villains that, "I'm going to go find the Batcave." And they all said, you can't find the Batcave. And he goes, "Well, nobody with my supreme intellect has ever tried." And then he tells his henchmen to take dynamite and drill holes into the bedrock all around Gotham, in the city, in the outer areas of the Gotham, and put dynamite in the holes in the bedrock all around and light them off. And then, with his radar seismograph, he's going to be able to watch the sound waves travel through the ground. And it'll all travel in one speed through rock. It'll travel at a different speed in a pocket where there is no rock. How about that?
I like it. I like it. I mean, my brain's like firing off in every direction about the possible ways that with modern technology you could kind of work around that. So like, if you think about how like you can have a camouflage device that has basically screens and cameras on every side, and so you can have if somebody looks at it from one side, the screen is projecting the camera on the opposing side, so you would see straight through it. So I'm trying to like figure out what the seismographic equivalent of that would be if you can have like some sort of like dampening thing that would also create a fake signal, and you would like know how to align that with whichever direction. I think like it's maybe possible, but probably not at that time, at least, because this was like early days, right?
That's early, like, what, I don't even want to give a date, but a long time ago. Silver Age.
Yeah.
A long time ago.
But smart move. I mean, he was a mechanical engineer, right? That villain.
Victor Danning was an engineer, yes. A lot of the villains are... the funny thing about comic books is the heavy reliance on scientists. Scientists
as the bad guys.
Help the hero, the scientists to help the heroes, and scientists to combat the heroes. As a matter of fact, the Atom was a... his real identity is Ray Palmer, and he's a physics professor. So...
Oh, this is the guy who picked up a chunk of a white dwarf, right?
Yes. And the Atom, or Ray Palmer, physics professor, was working on a machine that would give him powers. And he was only missing one missing ingredient. And that's a common theme in a lot of villains in comic book history. They're all working on some horrible device or some machine that'll give them powers or abilities. They're just missing that one ingredient. Anyway, so the Atom found in the desert somewhere a chunk of white dwarf star, a rock sitting on the ground. That was exactly what he needed to give him his powers. And he had an incredibly hard time lifting up the small rock because he says, as he says in the comic books, white dwarfs are dense and made of dense degenerate matter.
Which is true.
Which is true. But one thing they got wrong is that when he discovered the white dwarfs, he put all his effort into picking up this rock made of white dwarf matter. As scientists often do who are comic book fans, they take a measurement, make an estimate of sizes or something in the comic. In this case, the rock had a radius of approximately 6 inches. They gauged that by, they could see the Atom's hands holding it and his belt and all these other things. So it's about 6 inches in radius. So a rock with a radius about 6 inches that's made of of white dwarf matter is going to weigh 50,000 tons.
Yeah.
I don't think if it matters at that point if it's metric tons or U.S. tons for all you people out there. It's 50,000 of them.
Yeah.
I don't think I mean, you can like, pick up 50,000 feathers. 50,000 is a lot.
Well, I mean, what's heavier, like a kilogram of feathers or a kilogram of steel?
Well, that's a kilogram is a kilogram.
Aha, I see you've played this game before.
There's a funny, there's a similar joke. What's heavier? Is it a pound of gold or a pound of feathers? Mm-hmm. And there's an answer. Pound of feathers is heavier.
Because you have to live with the weight of what you've done to those poor birds.
Because in our beautiful measurement system, there are more ounces to a pound of feather, because they're measured as grains, than there is ounces to a pound of metal, which is measured as a pound everywhere else. So you could take your metric system and stick it, because we've got class. We've got all sorts of nice little differences in here. We make measuring fun is what we do here.
You make measuring chaotic, and it's not even chaotic neutral. I just, oh dear Lord. The kids, stay in school and don't try the imperial system.
Just use the metric system. You'll enjoy it.
Please use the metric system.
You'll enjoy it.
dear Lord. But yeah, like white dwarf matter, a teaspoon of it would weigh as much as probably like 5,000 tons.
Right. And he wouldn't have found it on the ground. It would be in the core.
No.
Something that heavy, even the ground couldn't support it.
Well, yeah. Sorry, I said 5,000. Five tons for a teaspoon of that material, it would be like having like a massive, like a truck, right?
Right.
And so if you're talking about like thousands of times that, what? How? Whomst? I don't know. But cool. I mean, white dwarfs in comics. Love it. Love to see it. We spoke about white dwarfs last week in our Hertzsprung-Russell diagram.
The Hertzsprung-Russell diagram. That was a fun one.
I liked it.
I liked it very much.
All right. What's up next?
Let's talk about The Flash. Let's get this one over quick.
Okay.
In a very early comic episode or issue of The Flash, he was having trouble during one of the very first attempts of trying to reach light velocity. Mm-hmm. As they called it, light velocity. As he's running, all the little word bubbles and thought bubbles are appearing next to his head. As he's getting faster and faster, he's saying things like, something's wrong. I'm feeling tired. Maybe I didn't eat enough. I'm feeling heavy. Something's wrong. The closer I'm getting to light speed, the heavier I'm getting. And this is in a very early edition of the comic of The Flash when he was wearing the little wings on his head.
Oh, yeah.
Why, Kavi? Why was it getting heavier? This one I love.
It's great. So, I'm curious because he was like a science major, right?
The Flash?
Barry Allen, not The Flash.
Yeah, Barry Allen. He's one of the smarter superheroes, yes.
He's one of the smarter ones. So it's odd that he's not familiar with one of these fundamental aspects. And I think one of the most fun aspects to discuss in terms of, you know, like cool science that'll get the kids interested. So there's this factor called the Lorentz factor, right? So when you're talking about traveling at a particular velocity V, and you're comparing that to the speed of light C. So the Lorentz factor will be, it's like 1 over the square root of 1 minus V over C squared, right? And that ratio of V to C increases as you go to higher and higher velocities. But because that's in the denominator, right, in the square root thing, the Lorentz factor right? So it basically explodes. And as a result of that, because what we do is we use the Lorentz factor to figure out relativistic adjustments, relativistic transformations. So, you know, all these effects that we've spoken about in the past, like time dilation, the idea of, you know, length contraction, that things in different, you know, relativistic frames would appear to contract or extend. Or the way that we actually do this calculation is by using the Lorentz factor, because that will accurately tell us how much time is dilating by or how much the thing is contracting by. And so the simplest way to explain this would just be to say, oh, well, the mass is going to be scaled up by the Lorentz factor. And, you know, basically it will increase as you move to higher and higher velocities. But the way that I always think about it is the energy required to increase incrementally your velocity increases exponentially as you move to higher and higher velocities. So if you had to, you know, put in X energy to run a little bit faster, then to make the next increase in your speed, it's not just, you know, plus another X energy. It's increasing exponentially. And basically you get to the point where to accelerate something to the speed of light requires infinite energy. Like the function just kind of goes whoop, like all the way up. So that is why he was finding he needed to put in more energy, why he felt more sluggish. It's all because of the Lorentz factor and the, you know, the relative velocity.
The Lorentz factor. I'm writing that down. Flash versus the Lorentz factor.
Yes. Yeah. Lorentz factor.
That in the crits. Show notes when this episode goes up.
Nice. Oh, I just remembered we haven't done an ad.
Let's do an ad.
So superheroes, they're great, right?
That's what I heard.
We've heard this, you know, saving the day, stopping villains, but let's face it, they're a little rough on property and timelines. So that is where we come in. Superhero damage control. We specialize in fixing the collateral damage of your friendly neighborhood hero, whether it's a skyscraper reduced to rubble or a time anomaly that's messed up your entire day. We've got you covered. Call Superhero Damage Control today, because even superheroes need a good cleanup crew.
Heck yeah! There's actually a few comics that cover like those types of cleanup crews and insurance programs. I wonder how a timeline would mess up your day. Would you even know?
Oh, interesting.
Right?
Oh yeah, back to the grandfather paradox, are we?
Well,
it's like if you make a change that affects your timeline, do you experience it retroactively, or does that change just affect this new timeline that is splintered off?
Not according to physicist and huge comic book and movie fan Michio Kaku. I like him. Well, I like his work. I am just a simpleton who reads the books and watches the YouTube videos, so I can't say if this guy is full of hot air, but makes it sound good. And according to him, the paradox is like going back in time and making it so your parents never met. How could you have gone back in time if you were never born, if they never met? Well, you're not messing up your timeline. You're messing up an alternate timeline. You've left your time. As soon as you time travel to some other point in time, you have now left your timeline. You've entered another timeline. Every single action you take, if you do it or you don't, if you have the option to do it or you don't, those are two separate timelines, according to what Dr. Michio Kaku said. So if there's a universe in which Marty McFly's parents didn't meet, and Marty McFly from a universe where they did meet went into that universe, he would only be mucking about and messing up things in that universe, not in the universe that he came from.
It's kind of like this idea of causal locality, right? So like mm-hmm. you can only like the causal relationship between events only holds within one local timeline. And yeah, that's definitely one interpretation. And Michio Kaku is a very, very smart man. I wouldn't necessarily agree with a lot of his approaches to science communication, and maybe the fact that he's focused most of his theoretical career on string theory, which, well, if you follow the string, hasn't necessarily led anywhere.
Oh.
But
again,
but yeah, it was an interesting. Yeah, it was definitely an interesting direction to take theoretical physics in. But yeah, no, that like whole timeline stuff has been all over superhero mythology, and certainly in recent time as well. It's been kind of showing up more and more, alternate timelines, alternate right. dimensions as well.
Mm-hmm.
Although I guess sometimes we'll be seeing the alternate dimensions, spatial dimensions, showing up in like Doctor Strange, where yeah, Doctor Strange
has really pushed the has pushed the boundaries of falling in and out of multiple dimensions. I can't even begin to start talking about that one, other than it looks cool on the screen, and there you have it.
I think he's a doctor, sure, but like I think they kind of left the science in the lobby. Like,
oh, yeah, not even at the door. It's not even science, okay, not even let in the building at that one, at that point.
They forgot the science on the train on the way to the building.
Yeah. Well, it's cool, moving though. Along.
Yes.
Moving along. Kind of a timeline-ish, time travel-ish story is with Captain Marvel.
Mm.
When I don't know how many people saw the Captain Marvel movies, but it took place in the 90s, which is kind of cool. Mm-hmm. And the main character, she's young and energetic, and she's a superhero, or becomes a superhero sometime in the 90s. And then 25-ish years later, she shows up again for the Avengers Endgame movie. All the heroes here on Earth have been through several adventures and movies in that time, and they're older and grayer and no worse for the wear. And she shows up looking fresh, as if she just left the stage of that movie of hers, and now she's here. At the end of her own movie, she flew off into space of her own free will, just glowing and flying and looking for the Skrulls on some other planet somewhere else in space. And so she's zooming around incredibly fast, near the speed of light, interplanetary travel. And a lot of people who have been watching the movies with some sort of a science-minded eye, they think that this is where time dilation has come into play. She's been zooming around near light speed for months and months. But when she gets back to Earth for the big fight, everyone else has been here for years. And she's just, hi. Which is odd because you can communicate to her with a beeper.
No comment on the beeper, I guess. But on the time dilation, that is, it relates directly to the Lorentz factor that we were just talking about before. So basically, the passage of time as experienced by Captain Marvel, versus the passage of time experienced by someone here on Earth. So that like difference in time, they would not be experiencing relative to one another in the same way. So like the change in time for one is equal to the change in time for the other multiplied by the Lorentz factor, right? And generally, as people move at, squeaked my little rubber ducky accidentally, as people, an observer in a movement that is closer and closer to the speed of light, they will experience time more slowly relative to somebody on Earth, right? So it's important for me to say that in any local frame, right? So like, even if I'm moving at the speed of light or near the speed of light, I would still experience time normally. Love that little Spider-Man. Benjamin is holding up a doll of Spider-Man who cannot move at the speed of light. So basically, when you are traveling at the speed of light, or you are traveling next to a massive object, while you in your own frame of reference still experience the passage of time normally, the faster you are moving, or the closer you are moving to a massive object, like, you know, a star or a black hole, the slower you appear to be moving, or the slower you appear to be experiencing time relative to an external observer. So somebody from the outside, as, you know, we just spoke about in this example of Captain Marvel, they would, you know, feel like they have experienced time for longer than you have, if that makes sense.
It does make sense. And I realized I was muted the entire time, so I couldn't interrupt. All right.
What were you saying about the Spider-Man?
Something about Spider-Man, and then it came up, and I'm like, oh, I have a Spider-Man. And then you just kept going, and I realized, oh, I'm muted. It's okay. It's okay. I was listening. That was fantastic. Time dilation. Anyway, since we're talking about Spider-Man, since he's here.
he's just hanging in. He swung by.
A fun thing about Spider-Man is his spider webs. And in the very first Spider-Man movie, he stops a runaway train by standing in front of it and just shooting off a whole bunch of webs against the surrounding buildings. And the beautiful part about this is that Jim Kakalios and many other scientists who enjoy superhero movies, just from the footage alone from that scene, are able to semi-accurately calculate the tensile strength of Spider-Man's webs. You can look up the mass of a train. You can estimate how fast it's going by watching how long it takes to pass surrounding things like a building or another train or something like that.
Sure.
You can count how many webs Spider-Man shoots off, and you can see how long it takes from the time he shoots them all off, how long it takes for the train to come to a stop. Mm-hmm. Calculate that time. It goes from a speed of whatever you figured out to a speed of zero. And you can see just how far the webs themselves stretch. And so all this information is there, and it's been calculated that Spider-Man's webbings, or Tobey Maguire's webbings, has a tensile strength of about 1,000 megapascals, or about 140,000 pounds per square inch, which is strong. And the best part about that is it's accurate, because real spider silk has a tensile strength of about 1,200 megapascals, which I love. But it's much shorter and much thinner, so we're able to break it, but yeah, a spider's prey cannot.
Although I guess it would only really be accurate if he was like shooting the webs out of a different part of his body other than his hands.
Oh, spider.
Oh, man. Yeah, okay, so it's cool to see that there's actually a fair amount of scientific accuracy, or at least like scientists or some science that goes into the thinking behind some of these characters. I like that.
Yeah. For the Avengers, Captain America's famous shield is made out of something called vibranium. Mm-hmm. It's a very rare metal. That's all lands in Wakanda or whatever. But this metal, it absorbs all vibration.
Mm-hmm.
Period. And in the comic books, these scenes like these have happened, and it was best represented in the first Avengers movie when Thor meets Captain America for the first time. And yeah. Iron Man tells Thor, put the hammer down. And Thor says, you want me to put the hammer down? And he puts the hammer down and he smashes it right into Captain America's shield. And what takes place is something that's actually spoken about in the comic books. Captain America himself says, energy can't be destroyed, right? It just transfers into something else. And so when Thor's hammer, which itself is made out of a white dwarf star or neutron star.
I think so, yeah.
Something like that.
Something like that.
When it hits the shield, it doesn't dent the shield and there's no vibration. But instead what there is all that energy is turned into huge bright light, a huge ringing sound, a shockwave that just knocks down trees in all directions. It's a massive sort of explosion because all that energy has to go somewhere. We can't actually make vibranium. There isn't a material like that, but there are many steel alloys out there that are pretty gosh darn strong, but not really. But
this is reminding me of, so like, I don't know how well understood it is, pardon me. But there is this idea that when you have like a bubble in a liquid and it's hit with a shock wave, a sound wave, there's this like little emission of light. It's like rather than bioluminescence, it's like sonoluminescence, that basically that sound wave produces, like the sound wave hitting and causing that implosion of a bubble in a liquid can create light. And that's like the transfer of energy, which is sounds kind of like what you're describing.
Actually, there's an animal that can do that. And I know that because the very first thing I ever made that went viral was a picture of a tiger pistol shrimp. It's this weird little crustacean at the bottom of the ocean. Mm-hmm. It looks like a shrimp, but it has one claw that is huge, almost as big as its body. Just one. And what it does is that it makes a snap with its claw. So incredibly loud and powerful, it stuns nearby prey and it can just eat it. But what is absolutely hysterical to me, and apparently to the 4 million or so people who liked it or saw it or shared it or whatever, thank you all from years ago, is that it creates a sound so incredibly large, it's deafening to people listening to sonar on submarines. It creates a sound so loud, it could almost kill itself. And I don't know why it evolved to do this. It creates a spark of light if you can see it. And inside that spark of light, the temperature is on the order of thousands of degrees for one small little speck. And for one brief instant of time, it creates this little hyper hot ball of pain that's instantly absorbed and just diminished by the water around it. 'Cause it's a small thing, but it's incredible that it just creates this little boom.
You know what? I think they should remake the Avengers, but have Thanos be a tiger pistol shrimp. And that way when he's doing the snaps, it's the snaps themselves that are causing the damage. All right. Is there any more final superhero science that you want to bring up before we wrap this up?
I have a few, but I think I like where we are. One more. Do I have one more? What's a good one? Very simply, Iron Man. Mm-hmm. Iron Man suit is 100% possible with the technology that we have today, except for the power supply.
Thank you.
Everything else is possible. From the ability to make a little flight suit, to the strength of the armor, to the onboard computer that's supposedly it's a cybernetic helmet that connects, it reads your thoughts and it can do a few things. That kind of exists today. Okay. The weight of the suit, the ability to embed all the different sorts of weaponry that he uses. It's all possible. All of it. Except given today's power abilities, you'd have to be plugged into a city.
Yeah.
But it, there's no, it'd have to there's be. No arc reactor. Not yet.
Well, also, I think having an arc reactor in your chest, like thermodynamically, there would be like residual heat from that would probably like melt through every other aspect of the suit. But yeah, you'd kind of, for the lack of some other energy source that's mobile, you would kind of need to have like, you know, those extendo dog leashes, like that, exactly. But with an extension cord. And so like Iron Man could like fly and fight bad guys, but only within like a small radius, and then just like hits the end.
There's a Japanese anime cartoon called Evangelion, in which there are these Godzilla type monsters that come and attack various cities. But the cities have for protection these massive, massive robots. And the only way to use them is if everybody in the city goes for a blackout. This thing comes out of the ground. It is literally plugged in, like you just described, from the back into the city. And it uses the city's power supply. And it can only last for as long as the city can remain powered. And if it has... And if it goes and fights, and it somehow gets disconnected from the city, the pilot on board and the robot itself literally has this counting down thing. You have 5 more minutes. That's it. Otherwise, you have no more power and you can't keep moving. So that's like part of it. They recognize that nothing that colossal that's man-made can work with the power supplies that we have today unless you've literally plugged it into a city.
Right. But Tony Stark built this in a cave.
With scraps.
With scraps. Oh, man. I watched that movie way too many times when it came out.
It's a great movie.
It's a good one. I like it. I like it very much. Cool. This has been a fun and surprising.
This has been a fun one.
Scientific episode.
Yeah. See? Science is everywhere. Thank you, all you comic book writers and artists who consult with scientists or at least have an affinity for science before you make your little storylines. It actually makes it a lot more fun.
Definitely. We thank you for that. And we thank you, our listeners and watchers, for coming back for another episode of Science Actually Presents the Nerd and the Scientist. Benjamin, where can the good people track you down on the interwebs?
The good people can track me down. Just look for the science action signal in the sky when evildoers are afoot. You can find that science signal on Facebook, on Twitter, on Instagram, Threads, TikTok, LinkedIn, Mastodon, Hive. Yeah, look for science actually in all those places. How about you, Kavi?
I love how you went for the bat signal, but not the World Wide Web when you have Spider-Man right in front of you. But that's fine. You can find me at Fun Fact Science on all the good social media platforms and also the bad ones. This has been another fun episode of Science Actually Presents the Nerd and the Scientist, and we will catch you all, especially you, Benjamin, next time.
Later, gang.
Little Mr. Captain Amazing. Well, Captain, if we had a billionaire like Lance Hunt as our benefactor, yeah, we could spend 150.
That's because Lance Hunt is Captain Amazing.
Oh, don't start that again. Lance Hunt wears glasses. Captain Amazing doesn't wear glasses.
He takes them off when he transforms.
That doesn't make any sense. He wouldn't be able to see.